NBA playoff series. What they won't have on Wednesday night in Boston is Kristaps Porzingis, who went down in the first half with a right calf injury. He left the arena in a walking boot, often used as a precaution, but he was declared out on Tuesday, and his timetable to return is uncertain. Meanwhile, Boston got plenty of production from their guard. "I made a couple of shots early," said White, who was 15 of 26 from the field and 8 of 15 from three-point range. "That always helps. Once you make a couple, the basket looks huge." Jason Tatum added 20 points and 10 rebounds for the Celtics, who got 17 points from Jaylen Brown and 11 from Drew Holiday. "We had to keep fighting," Tatum said, "and play desperate in a way." Bam Adebayo finished with 25 points, 17 rebounds, and 5 assists for Miami, which had a sellout crowd, including Lionel Messi, but played again without injured starters Jimmy Butler with a knee injury and Terry Rozier with a neck injury. The Heat managed only 84 points in Game 3 and struggled again on offense in Game 4. Tyler Herro scored 19 points and Caleb Martin had 18 for the 8th-seeded Heat. Miami lost rookie starter Jamie Jacquez Jr. in the second half with leg tightness. He will be evaluated on Tuesday. "Offensively, we struggled again," Heat coach Eric Spoelstra said. "We had some decent looks early on, weren't able to knock those down, and Derek White was very good tonight. Obviously, he was just very efficient, very good." The Celtics can advance to the second round on Wednesday when they host Game 5. The Boston-Miami winner will meet the Cleveland-Orlando winner in the East semifinals. The Cavaliers-Magic series won't end until at least on Friday. And we will tell you what's on the air today. We'll start with baseball, 6:30 p.m. The Yankees again down to Baltimore. That's on Prime Video, also Radio 97.9. 7 p.m., the Giants, again up at Boston. That's on Nesson, Radio 1080, WTIC. And at 7 p.m., the Chicago Cubs at the New York Mets. That's on SNY, Radio 880, CBS, WCBS. In basketball, as I just mentioned, the Eastern Conference first-round playoff, Miami at Boston, Game 5, 7:30 p.m., TNT. 10 p.m., Western Conference first-round playoff, Dallas at the L.A. Clippers. That is Game 5 on TNT. And finally, in hockey, and at 9:30 p.m., Western Conference first-round playoff, Los Angeles at Edmonton, Game 5. That is on ESPN. Unfortunately, I do not have the Boston Bruins-Toronto score from last night. They played up at Boston. I do not have that score. We'll have that for you probably tomorrow. And one more note before we sign off. Defending FedEx Cup champion Victor Hovland has committed to the 2024 Travelers Championship, the tournament announced on Tuesday. The 26-year-old native of Norway made his professional golf debut on a sponsored exemption at the 2019 Travelers. He also took part in the event in 2020 and last season with his best finish coming in 2020 when he tied for 11. That's all for the sports for today. Thank you very much for listening. I'm Bill Murphy. Hope you have a great day, everybody, and please stay safe.
Thanks for spending this part of your day with Chris, Connecticut's Talking Newsstand.
Welcome to tonight's installment of the Regional Roundup on Chris. We invite you to join us for the next hour as we feature the top national, state, and local stories making headlines today.
From the Chris Broadcast Center in Windsor, here is tonight's Regional Roundup.
Hello, everybody. Today is Wednesday, May 1st. I am Bill Murphy here with the front pages. I'll be reading from the New York Times and the Hartford Courant. We'll take a look at the pictures on the front pages of each paper. On the front page of the Times, picture pro-Palestinian demonstrators, and they are barricading themselves inside Hamilton Hall on the Columbia campus early on Tuesday morning. There's big bars there and some guards that are outside. I believe that's what they are. And then you can see some of the students who are barricading themselves so nobody can get in. Of course, there's protests all over the country. I think we're going to have a story later on what's going on up at UConn. Over to the Hartford Courant, a pretty cute picture here. It's a little boy in the hometown foundation, Adele, the new service dog for the Autism Center at the Hospital for Special Care in New Britain, sits with a patient on Tuesday. The patient is not identified. Adele was donated by the Hometown Foundation, Incorporated, and trained by the Forever in My Heart Foundation. And he's just sitting there. Little boy's playing with a toy truck, and Adele is looking at him with great interest. And on his little sign on the on his back, it says "Forever in My Heart Foundation Service Dog." One more picture, another picture of Adele, and this time they do identify the little boy. His name is Alex Nelson. I have that wrong. I'm sure Alex Nelson is the speech and language therapist at the Hospital for Special Care, and he's working with a patient. I believe it's the same patient that I described in the top picture, but we do not know the name of the little boy. He looks like he's about two and a half or three, and he's working with a patient there, and they get support from Adele, who's just lying there looking at what they are doing. So we're going to go right over to the New York Times, and we're going to read the first story. I have two stories from the Times. He was the man behind the hush money, the amiable Beverly Hills lawyer who specialized in celebrity dirt, unearthing it and then, for the right price, burying it forever. But in 2016, the lawyer, Keith Davidson, was on the verge of something grander than a run-of-the-mill sex tape or affair. He had two clients shopping stories so big they might sway a presidential election. Their names were Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal, and they were ready to tell the world about their sexual encounters with Donald J. Trump. On Tuesday, Mr. Davidson took the witness stand at Mr. Trump's criminal trial in Manhattan, telling jurors the behind-the-scenes story of how Mr. Trump's allies bought his client's silence. His hours of testimony opened a rare window on the seamy world of celebrity hush money and corroborated key facts underpinning the prosecution's case against Mr. Trump, the first American president to face a criminal trial. In a crucial back and forth with prosecutors, Mr. Davidson began to tie Mr. Trump to the $130,000 hush money payment to Ms. Daniels, the porn star, whose payoff is at the heart of the case. Although Mr. Trump did not pay Ms. Daniels directly, his fixer, Michael D. Cohen, did. Mr. Davidson portrayed Mr. Trump as the hidden hand shaping the machinations. Michael Cohen didn't have the authority to actually spend money, Mr. Davidson said to the jury, adding, "My understanding was that Mr. Trump was the beneficiary of this contract." The testimony punctuated a high-stakes day that began with the judge holding Mr. Trump in contempt, fining the former president $9,000 for repeatedly violating a gag order and warning that he could go to jail if he continued to attack witnesses and jurors. "The court will not tolerate continued willful violations of its lawful orders," the judge, Juan M. Merchant, said in an ominous warning to open the third week of Mr. Trump's trial. He added that although he was keenly aware of and protective of defendants' First Amendment rights, he would jail Mr. Trump if necessary and appropriate. The judge's crackdown injected instant tension into the day's proceedings before three new witnesses took the stand. The most significant was Mr. Davidson, who began by recounting his representation of Ms. McDougal, a Playboy model who said she had an affair with Mr. Trump in 2006. In a striking stretch of testimony, Mr. Davidson read aloud for the jury a series of off-color text exchanges from 2016, telling National Enquirer editor that he had a blockbuster Trump stories about Mr. Trump cheating on his wife Melania Trump with Ms. McDougal. When some of Ms. McDougal's female friends urged her to go to ABC News instead, Mr. Davidson warned that the story might slip away if the National Enquirer didn't pay, and fast. "Time is of the essence," said Mr. Daniels. He actually wrote it. "The girl is being cornered by the estrogen mafia," a message that Mr. Davidson mortified by his years-old remarks, called a very unfortunate, regrettable text during his testimony. The testimony offered another remarkable moment in a trial whose early days have been full of them, a former president, the current Republican nominee, watching helplessly as two strangers exposed details of a sex scandal that he had fought to keep secret. It also underscored the array of evidence at the prosecution's disposal as it assembled its case. On Tuesday alone, prosecutors introduced live testimony from Mr. Davidson and three other witnesses, a string of provocative text messages, videos of Trump campaign events, and excerpts from a deposition the former president gave in a separate case, all woven into a story they said pairs Mr. Trump as a criminal. As Mr. Davidson got deeper into details, his testimony also bolstered a key component of the prosecution's contention that the Inquirer was involved in a secret plot to boost Mr. Trump's candidacy. The publication bought Ms. McDonald's silence for $150,000, but balked at laying out a huge sum for Ms. Daniels, so the tabloid instead notified Mr. Cohen that Ms. Daniels was shopping her story, setting it in motion, and that led to the $130,000 hush money deal. Mr. Davidson provided jurors with a detailed account of negotiations in Ms. Daniels' case. Although her story of a tryst with Mr. Trump had been floating around for years, he noted that interest in it spiked after the emergence of the Access Hollywood tape on which Mr. Trump bragged about groping women. The tape sent Mr. Trump's campaign into a tailspin, but if Ms. Daniels' story got out, Mr. Davidson said it could have gotten a lot worse. When Mr. Cohen was slow to pay, Mr. Davidson recalled phoning him to say, "This is a very bad situation," warning that Ms. Daniels and her agent were preparing to go public. Mr. Cohen became agitated, noting that my guy, Mr. Trump, was campaigning in several states that day, and I'm doing everything I can. Eventually, Mr. Cohen made the payment himself, and Mr. Trump reimbursed him. Prosecutors have charged Mr. Trump, who faces up to 4 years in prison with falsifying business records, to cover up that repayment. And another related story in the New York Times, Donald J. Trump's Manhattan criminal trial had barely begun when he started to turn his anger toward his lead lawyer, Todd Blanche. Although Mr. Blanche has been Mr. Trump's favorite lawyer for some time behind closed doors and in phone calls, the former president has complained repeatedly about him in recent weeks, according to four people familiar with the situation. He has griped that Mr. Blanche, a former federal prosecutor and veteran litigator, has not been following his instructions closely and has been insufficiently aggressive. Mr. Trump wants him to attack witnesses, attack what the former president sees as a hostile jury pool, and attack the judge, Juan M. Merchant. Mr. Trump, who often complains about legal fees and sometimes refuses to pay them, has also wondered aloud why his lawyers cost so much, according to the people who all spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss the sensitive topic. Nearly every lawyer who has ever represented Mr. Trump has spent time in the blast zone, but as he enters the third week of his first criminal trial, one that not only threatens his campaign to become president again, but also could send him to prison, the question of whether his lawyers can win enough leeway from his desires and never loomed larger. Mr. Trump views himself as his own best legal strategist. Since becoming president, he has cast about four lawyers who would do exactly what he wanted, including helping him stay in office after he lost the 2020 election. He has vented to others that he does not have a Roy Cohn, a reference to the notoriously ruthless former lawyer Mr. Cohn, who represented Mr. Trump in his formative business years, was repeatedly indicted and ultimately disbarred. Jason Miller, a Trump campaign senior advisor, said Monday that the former president and his team were focused entirely on fighting a ridiculous case and that anonymous comments from people who aren't in the room are just that, he added. I would be highly skeptical of any gossip or hearsay surrounding this case. Alina Haba, a legal spokeswoman for Mr. Trump, described Mr. Blanche as a crucial part of the team. Mr. Blanche declined to comment for this article. And we're going to move over now to the Hartford Courant. And more on Donald Trump and the trial. Donald Trump was held in contempt of court Tuesday and fined $9,000 for repeatedly violating a gag order that barred him from making public statements about witnesses, jurors, and some others connected to his New York hush money case. If he does it again, the judge warned, he could be jailed. Prosecutors alleged 10 violations, but New York Judge Juan Merchant found there were 9. Trump stared down at the table, frowning slightly as the judge read the ruling. It was a stinging rebuke of the presumptive Republican presidential nominee's insistence that he was exercising his free speech rights, and a reminder that he's a criminal defendant subject to the harsh realities of trial procedure. And the judge's remarkable threat to jail a former president signaled that Trump's already precarious legal standing could further spiral depending on his behavior during the remainder of the trial. Merchant wrote that he is keenly aware of and protective of Trump's First Amendment rights, particularly given his candidacy for the office of President of the United States. It is critically important that defendant's legitimate free speech rights not be curtailed, that he be able to fully campaign for the office which he seeks, and that he be able to respond and defend himself against political attacks, Merchant said. Still, he warned that the court would not tolerate willful violations of its lawful orders, and that if necessary and appropriate under the circumstances, it will impose an incarcerationary punishment. This gag order is totally unconstitutional, Trump said as court adjourned. Tuesday's ruling came at the start of the second week of testimony in the historic case, which involves allegations that Trump and his associates took part in the illegal scheme to influence the 2016 presidential campaign by purchasing and then bearing seamy stories. The payouts went to a doorman with a torrid yarn, ex-Playboy model Kara McDougal, who had accusations of an affair, and a porn performer Stormy Daniels, who alleged a sexual encounter with Trump. He has pleaded not guilty and says the stories are all fake. Trump deleted, as ordered, the offending posts from his Truth Social account and campaign website and has until Friday to pay the fine. The judge was also weighing other alleged gag order violations by Trump and will hear arguments Thursday. He also announced that that he will halt the trial on May 17th to allow Trump to attend his son Barron's high school graduation. Testimony resumed Tuesday with a banker who helped Cohen open accounts, including one used to buy Daniel's silence. Trump's attorneys have suggested that the payments were aimed at protecting his name and his family, not influencing the outcome of the presidential election. Jurors also began hearing from Keith Davidson, a lawyer who represented McDougal and Daniels in their negotiations with the National Enquirer and Cohen. He testified that he arranged a meeting at his Los Angeles office during the summer of 2016 to see whether the tabloid's parent company was interested in McDougal's story. At first, they demurred, saying that she, quote, lacked documentary evidence of the interaction, Davidson testified, but the tabloid, at the behest of publisher David Pecker, eventually bought the rights, and Davidson testified that he understood and McDougal preferred it would never be published. Asked why the tabloid's parent company, American Media Incorporated, would buy a store like that, it didn't tend to run. Davidson said he was aware of two reasons. One explanation I was given is they were trying to build Karen into a brand and didn't want to diminish her brand, he said. And the second was an unspoken understanding that there was an affiliation between David Pecker and Donald Trump, and that AMI wouldn't run this story, any story related to Karen, because it would hurt Donald Trump. We're going to go to the weather now. I have the national forecast from the New York Times and then the local forecast. Here's the national forecast. Showers will quickly move off the coast of New England this morning. However, showers and thunderstorms will linger for much of the day from New Jersey to North Carolina. Sea breeze thunderstorms will occur across the Florida Peninsula during the afternoon. A storm will bring showers and thunderstorms to much of the plains, with a zone of severe thunderstorms developing from Nebraska to central Texas late in the day. These thunderstorms will be capable of producing flash flooding, damaging winds, hail, and several tornadoes. Ahead of the storm, warmth will build into the Ohio and Mississippi valleys. In the west, showers will continue across the Rockies, while the Pacific Northwest and the Southwest will be dry. We'll take a quick break and be back with the local forecast right after that.
Join us Saturdays at 5:30 p.m. and Sundays at 2:30 p.m. for the Reader's Digest. I'm Chris.
The forecast for tonight is mostly cloudy, with a low around 49. Tomorrow, Thursday, will be cloudy, then gradually becoming mostly sunny, with a high near 76. And tomorrow night will be partly cloudy, with a low around 48. Friday, there's a chance of showers. It'll be partly sunny, with a high near 67. And Friday night, a chance of showers, mostly cloudy, with a low around 46. Saturday, there's a chance of showers. It'll be mostly cloudy, with a high near 65. And Saturday night, a chance of showers, mostly cloudy, with a low around 46. Have a good evening. Thank you for listening to Chris.
Now, back to that story. Police at the University of Connecticut cracked down on student protesters Tuesday morning, arresting those who were part of a Gaza Solidarity encampment on the store's campus. Student organizers reported that 25 protesters were arrested. Students said that police encircled and dismantled the encampment established April 24th to demand the university break ties with Israel and divest from companies supporting the country's war in Gaza that has left tens of thousands of civilians dead since Hamas's October 7th attack. The students had remained at the encampment after the university on April 24th issued a statement prohibiting tents on the property and declaring a 24-hour quiet period through the end of the semester. Stephanie Reitz, spokesperson for the school, issued a statement Tuesday morning saying about 20 tents remained Monday afternoon, and the group continued to use amplified sound despite the recently stated university policy. Students had said they would maintain the demonstration until their demands were met. The group was warned multiple times over a period of days that while they were free to be in the space and exercise their free speech rights, the guidelines needed to be followed and the tents needed to be taken down. This was ignored, Reed said. UConn police directed them four times on Tuesday morning to remove the tents and disperse, and then again repeatedly ignored the directives. Officers then entered the site to remove the tents and tarps and to arrest those who refused to compliance. One student who wished to be identified only by his first name, Chris, said approximately 80 police officers and state troopers encircled the encampment and began arresting demonstrators shortly after 7:30 a.m. Chris, a junior who served as police liaison for the encampment, said he was arrested and charged with disorderly conduct and criminal trespass. According to Chris, all students received the same charges. He said bond was set a $500 for each charge, totaling $1,000 for each student. We kind of were anticipating a raid coming this morning because we heard it was happening at Yale, Chris said. We expected that there was statewide coordination on this, which seemed to have been true. Students said the police blocked off the entrances and exits to the camps before making arrests. Over the megaphone, they told us that we had to disperse or they would arrest us, said one arrested student who wished to remain anonymous. After no one was moving, they started arresting people. First, they arrested the people who were chanting. Then they came up to the tents and they started taking people one by one. The student said that she was arrested and zip-tied. Afterwards, she said police brought students to the parking lot and transported them to the station in police vans. She said the arrested students kept protesting, laughing, and singing in the vans and the cells. We were having the best time ever, she said. The energy is very good. Despite the jubilance, the student emphasized the gravity of their mission. We want our university to know that we will go all the way for them to listen to our needs, she said. Other students expressed their frustrations with the arrest at the UConn Spirit Rock, painting the message, hands off our students. Students should have a voice, and for the officers and for administration here on campus to silence them is not something that should be happening, especially since it's peaceful, said LaJohn Bande, a sophomore. And we're going to go back to the front page for another story. While the volatile stock market still setting periodic records on Wall Street, state officials announced Tuesday that $1.1 billion in state income taxes will be set aside to pay off pension debts in a move that was described as shockingly good. The better-than-expected increase means that the projected state budget surplus for the current fiscal year is now $256 million, up by $170 million from only 11 days ago. The biggest increase in taxes came from capital gains taxes on Wall Street, which are paid largely by Fairfield County millionaires and billionaires on a quarterly basis. House Speaker Matt Ritter of Hartford emphasized that the state budget remains in solid shape after years of deficits in the past. This might be the most shocking consensus revenue numbers we've seen in years, Ritter told reporters at the state capitol. Positive? Yes. Right now we're in good times. Yes, it is Wall Street money, so we'll have to continue to talk about that as we go forward. If I hear the word deficit, folks, the state is in a very solid financial position. Ritter has said to be optimistic recently, saying he expects a vote in the coming days as the legislature expects to finalize its 2025 spending plans by reallocating about $300 million to $400 million in federal coronavirus money. That money remains unspent, and it will be reallocated by the legislature. Tax collections in April were surprisingly better than expected, several major categories, except for the sales tax, officials said. Estimates and finals under the personal income tax have been revised upward by $500 million as April collections were particularly strong. The budget director of the state, Jeffrey Beckham, said April collections under the corporation tax were also strong and that tax has been revised upward by $30 million. And similarly, pass-through entity tax revenue has been revised upward by $140 million as collections have exceeded estimates for this year. Offsetting this positive news, the sales and use tax has been revised downward by $20 million, continuing a string of disappointing monthly collections. And I have one more story that is on the front page of the Current. Rideshare drivers in Connecticut are being urged to support a new campaign to turn up the pressure on Uber and Lyft, demanding a stop to an erosion in pay and lack of job protection if riders complain about service. Excuse me. On Wednesday, a rally will be held at Bradley International Airport, one of more than a dozen locations around the country, where demonstrations and strikes are planned to draw public attention to the driver demands for fairer treatment by the two rideshare giants. Wednesday's event at the airport begins at 11:30 a.m. and comes a little over 2 months after a one-day strike in Connecticut. "We want people to know that we are still around," Adam Abubaker, a rally organizer and rideshare driver in Connecticut since 2016, said Tuesday. "We are still not happy, and we're never going to be happy until they give us a seat at the table." Abubaker, a member of the Justice for App Workers, which is organizing Wednesday's event, said the percentage of the fare that goes to drivers has been steadily decreasing since he started as a rideshare driver. Abubaker has said Uber and Lyft have cut driver share of fares to 20%, down from 47% or even higher when he first became a rideshare driver. "If it wasn't for the passenger giving us a tip, we're not going to make it," Abubaker said. "We pray for that. Drivers should not have to depend on tips," Abubaker said. Justice for App Workers is a national coalition representing more than 130,000 rideshare and delivery workers that seeks living wages, safe working conditions, and protections against unfair deactivations or being kicked off a rideshare platform. According to the organization, driver earnings per mile dropped from $1.40 in 2014 to 60 cents in 2022. Those numbers were based on driver interviews and published reports in the press, the organization said. At the same time, the cost of car maintenance, gas, insurance, and a used car purchase, all expenses for rideshare drivers, are at their highest point, or nearly so, in the past 6 years, the organization said. The Chicago Tribune and seven other newspapers sued Microsoft and OpenAI on Tuesday, claiming the technology giants illegally harvested millions of copyrighted articles to create their cutting-edge generative artificial intelligence products, including OpenAI's ChatGPT and Microsoft Copilot. While the newspaper's publishers have spent billions of dollars to send real people to real places to report on real events in the real world, the two tech firms are purloining the papers, reporting without compensation to create products that provide news and information plagiarized and stolen, according to the lawsuit in federal court. We cannot allow OpenAI and Microsoft to expand the big tech playbook of stealing our work to build their own businesses at our expense, said Frank Pine, executive director of Medical News Group and Tribune Publishing, which owns seven of the newspapers. The misappropriation of news content by OpenAI and Microsoft undermines the business model for news. These companies are building AI products clearly intended to supplement news publishers by repurposing our news content and delivering it to their users. The lawsuit was filed Tuesday morning in the Southern District of New York on behalf of the medical news group-owned Mercury News, Denver Post, Orange County Register, and St. Paul Pioneer Press, Tribune Publishing's Chicago Tribune, Orlando Sentinel, and South Florida Sun Sentinel, and the New York Daily News. The Independent Journal is part of MNG's Bay Area News Group, which includes the Mercury News and the East Bay Times. The Hartford Courant is also owned by the Tribune Public Company. We're going to go to the World of Nations section for this story again on Donald Trump. Former President Donald Trump told Time magazine in an interview published Tuesday that if elected in November, he would deploy the U.S. military to detain and deport migrants, hedged on the possibility of political violence after the 2024 election, said he would permit states to decide whether to prosecute those who violate abortion bans. He also did not express objections to the idea of states monitoring pregnancies. It's irrelevant whether I'm comfortable or not, he said. It's totally irrelevant because the states are going to make those decisions. Trump has rarely given lengthy interviews with mainstream news outlets, particularly since leaving the White House. His conversations with Time, a sit-down at his Mar-a-Lago residence in Palm Beach, Florida, and a follow-up phone call offer a revealing glimpse of how he would wield presidential power, challenge democratic norms, and reshape the country if he wins back the White House in November. At one point, Trump told Time that he would be willing to deploy the military as part of an extreme deportation operation he has said he plans to conduct if elected, and that he would be willing to bypass a law that prohibits using U.S. troops against civilians. Well, these aren't civilians, Trump said. These are people that aren't legally in our country. This is an invasion of our country. Trump also brushed aside questions about political violence in November by suggesting that his victory was inevitable. But when pressed about what might happen should he again lose the election, he did not dismiss the possible outright and did not proactively say anything to deter supporters from again resorting to do it. I think we're going to win, he said. If we don't win, you know, it depends. It always depends on the fairness of an election. The former president did say he would absolutely consider pardoning every person who had been convicted on or pleaded guilty to charges related to the storming of the Capitol on January 6, 2021. He noted that if somebody was evil and bad, I would look at that differently, but he did not say where he would draw the line. Trump and his allies have already laid the groundwork to advance their ideological agenda, and insights into their preparations have been reported by the New York Times and other outlets. Still, the Time interview, which includes transcripts, offered a rare chance to hear Trump describe his policy views in his own words. We're going to take a break and then be back with more front pages right after that.
Hi, I'm Rick Gray, a KRIS Radio volunteer. KRIS wants you to know that the Connecticut affiliate of the American Diabetes Association provides programs for diabetics, their families, and anyone affected by diabetes. Programs include support services, education, youth activities, public awareness, and professional offerings. Meetings are held throughout the state. For more information, call 800-842-6323. That's 800-842-6323. 6323 or call the state info line at 211.
This story from Washington. House Democrats will vote to save Republican Speaker Mike Johnson's job should some of his fellow Republican lawmakers seek to remove him from the position. Democratic leaders said Tuesday, likely assuring for now that Johnson will avoid being ousted from office like his predecessor, former Representative Kevin McCarthy. Johnson, Republican of Louisiana, has come under heavy criticism from some Republicans for moving forward with aid for Ukraine as part of a $95 billion emergency spending package that passed last month. It would take only a handful of Republicans to remove Johnson from the speakership if the Democratic caucus went along with the effort. But Democratic leaders took that possibility off the table. At this moment, upon completion of our national security work, the time has come to turn the page on this chapter of pro-Putin Republican obstruction, said a statement from the top three House Democrats, Representative Hakeem Jeffries, Catherine Clark, and Pete Aguilar. We will vote to table Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene's motion to vacate the chair. If she invokes the motion, it will not succeed. The announcement from Democrats ensures that Johnson will survive the most difficult stretch of his tenure so far, which saw him struggle through internal GOP divisions to pass government funding, the renewal of a key surveillance program, and aid for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. To do so, Johnson was often forced to rely on votes from Democrats, creating an unusual governing coalition that has angered hard-right members who say their majority is being squandered. Green, a Republican from Georgia, filed a resolution with the House clerk in March called a motion to vacate that would remove Johnson from office if approved by the House. And while Green did not force the resolution to be taken up immediately, she told reporters she was laying the groundwork for a future consideration. She had two co-sponsors, Representative Thomas Massey, Republican of Kentucky, and Paul Gosar, Republican of Arizona. Johnson was quick to distance himself from Democrats on the issue, saying he had no conversations with Jeffries or anyone else about saving his job. I was laser-focused on getting the supplemental done, Johnson said, referring to the aid package. I've had colleagues from both parties come up to me on the floor and, of course, say we won't stand for this. I've not requested assistance from anyone. I'm not focused on that at all. Many House Republicans are eager to move past the divisions that have tormented their ranks ever since taking the majority in January 2023. At a closed-door session Tuesday morning, much of the discussion focused on how to create unity in the party heading into the November elections. And we are on the World and Nation section page. This is from Washington. The U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration will move to reclassify marijuana as a less dangerous drug, an historic shift to generations of American drug policy that could have wide ripple effects across the country. The DEA's, that's the Drug Enforcement Administration proposal, which still must be reviewed by the White House Office of Management and Budget, would recognize the medical uses of cannabis and acknowledge it has less potential for abuse than some of the nation's most dangerous drugs. However, it would not legalize marijuana outright for recreational use. The agency's move, confirmed Tuesday by five people familiar with the matter who spoke on the condition of anonymity, clears the last significant regulatory hurdle before the agency's biggest policy change in more than 50 years can take effect. Since OMB signs off, the DEA will take public comment on the plan to move marijuana from its current classification as a Schedule 1 drug alongside heroin and LSD. It moves pot to Schedule 3 alongside ketamine and some anabolic steroids following a recommendation from the Federal Health and Human Services Department. After the public comment period and a review by the administrative judge, the agency would eventually publish the final rule. Today, the Attorney General circulated a proposal to reclassify marijuana from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3. Justice Department Director of Public Affairs Uchili Hinojosa said in a statement, once published by the Federal Register, it will initiate a formal rulemaking process as prescribed by Congress in the Controlled Substances Act. Attorney General Merrick Garland's signature throws the full weight of the Justice Department behind the move and appears to signal its importance to the Biden administration. It comes after President Joe Biden called for a review of federal marijuana law in October 2022 and moved to pardon thousands of Americans convicted federally of simple possession of the drug. He has also called on governors and local leaders to take similar steps to erase marijuana convictions. Criminal records for marijuana use and possession have imposed needless barriers to employment, housing, and educational opportunities, Biden said in December. Too many lives have been upended because of our failed approach to marijuana. It's time that we right those wrongs. From Port-au-Prince, Haiti. Haiti's newly installed transitional council shows a little-known former sports minister as the Caribbean country's prime minister Tuesday as part of its monumental task of trying to establish a stable new government amid stifling violence. Fritz Belizaire was chosen in a surprise move to replace current interim prime minister Michael Patrick Boisvert, gaining the support of four of the seven voting members on the nine-member panel, but with other panel members saying they were unfamiliar with Belizaire. The council also planned to choose a cabinet as it seeks to quell gang violence that is choking the capital, Port-au-Prince, and beyond. Heavy gunfire was reported in several of the capital's neighborhoods during the council's meeting. More than 90,000 people have fled the capital in the span of 1 month, and overall more than 360,000 people have been left homeless in recent years as gunmen raise communities in rival territories. Earlier Tuesday, the council chose former presidential candidate Edgar LeBlanc Fils as the president of the panel. "This is a very good choice for Prime Minister," Phil said of Belizaire during a brief speech to nearly two dozen attendees. "The important thing for us is this will, this determination to go beyond divisions, to overcome conflicts, and to reach a consensus." He said the council met Monday with army and police officials to talk about Haiti's security crisis and how best to resolve it. "We are publicly recognizing the suffering," he said, "of the population." The announcement of Belizaire was unexpected. A murmur rose through the attendees as officials announced that four council members with voting powers had selected Belizaire as prime minister. Belizaire served as Haiti's sports minister during the second presidency of René Préval from 2006 to 2011. "He's kind of an unknown figure," said Robert Fatten, a Haitian politics expert at the University of Virginia. "He doesn't seem to have his own constituency. Maybe that made him the likely prime minister so different parties can accept him as prime minister." And one more story from the World and Nation section of the Hartford Current. Dozens of protesters took over a building at Columbia University on Tuesday, barricading entrances and unfurling a Palestinian flag from a window in an escalation of demonstrations against the Israel-Hamas war on college campuses nationwide. The school promised they would face expulsion. The occupation at the campus in New York, where protesters have shrugged off an earlier ultimatum to abandon a tent encampment Monday or be suspended, unfolded as other universities stepped up efforts to end the protests. Police swept through some campuses, leading to confrontations and arrests. In rarer instances, university officials and protest leaders struck agreements to restrict the disruption to campus life. And in the Mideast, as ceasefire negotiations appeared to gain steam Tuesday, it wasn't clear whether those talks would inspire campus protesters to ease their efforts. Protesters on Columbia's Manhattan campus locked arms in front of Hamilton Hall early Tuesday and carried furniture and metal barricades to the building, among several occupied in a 1968 civil rights and anti-Vietnam War protest. Posts on an Instagram page for protest organizers shortly after midnight urged people to protect the encampment and join them at Hamilton Hall. A Free Palestine banner hung from a window. An autonomous group reclaimed Hines Hall, previously known as Hamilton Hall, in honor of Hein Rajab, a martyr murdered at the hands of the genocidal Israeli state at the age of 6 years old. CU Arthropod Deves posted on the social platform X early Tuesday. The takeover occurred nearly 12 hours after Monday's 2 p.m. Eastern Time deadline for the protesters to leave a 120 camp of tents or face suspension. In a statement on Tuesday, Columbia spokesperson Ben Chang said students occupying the building face expulsion. Chang said the university had given protesters a chance to leave peacefully and finish the semester, but those who didn't agree to the terms from Monday were being suspended, restricted from all academic and recreational spaces, allowed only to enter their residences, and for seniors ineligible to graduate. Protesters have chosen to escalate to an untenable situation, vandalizing property, breaking doors and windows, and blockading entrances. And we are following through with the consequences we outlined yesterday, he said. And we're going to move over now to the Connecticut section of the Hartford Current for the rest of our stories. Three educators have been chosen as finalists for the 2024 Hartford Public Schools Teacher of the Year. The annual Teacher of the Year award is given by a district-wide committee made up of HPS directors, officials from the Hartford Federation of Teachers, and previous Teacher of the Year winners after a months-long screening and interview process, according to the district. A field of 38 candidates was narrowed to just three finalists. Finalists, according to the district in a statement, are Angela Blake. She's a 7th and 8th grade science teacher at Betances STEM Magnet School. Blake, who was born and raised in Hartford, began her career with Hartford Public Schools 8 years ago, according to a press release. Yasmin Ethier Vicente is a 2nd grade teacher at West Middle School and has taught in Hartford for 8 years. She began as a behavior technician for the RISE program at McDonough Middle School and West Middle School. And finally, Jacqueline Rankin. She is a math teacher at Buckley High School and has also taught for 8 years in Hartford. A graduate of the University of Connecticut, Rankin began her career student teaching in Hartford. The 2024 Teacher of the Year will be announced on May 23rd at an awards ceremony in Hartford, at the downtown Marriott Hotel. We're going to take our final break now, and we will be back with the rest of the front pages. It'll all be from the Connecticut section after this message.
A Social Security program called Ticket to Work helps people who receive disability benefits earn more and transition to financial independence. Consider the case of Rob McLean, a successful businessman very active in his community. McLean had to stop working when his kidneys failed. He began receiving Social Security disability. After a transplant, he was eager to return to work, but he worried he'd lose his disability benefits before he could get a job and support himself. That's where Social Security's Ticket to Work and Work Incentives came in. They offer disability beneficiaries a range of free services to help them prepare for, find, and maintain employment. Participants can keep their Medicaid or Medicare coverage while working and retain some cash benefits while testing their ability to work. They may even get their benefits back if they can't continue working. To learn if you or someone you know is eligible for the Ticket to Work program or other work incentives, visit socialsecurity.gov/work.
And continuing on with the Connecticut section of the Current, state environmental officials are working with local police departments to keep illegal off-road vehicles off a popular trail in New Haven County. Authorities have recently received several complaints about ATVs and other off-road vehicles being used on the Larkin State Park Trail, a 10.3-mile trail that stretches through Middletown, Naugatuck, Southbury, and Oxford, according to the State Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. The trail, which travels along an old railroad line, is meant for walkers, joggers, and horseback riders, according to DEEP. Officials have learned from trail users and nearby property owners that some individuals have been using prohibited vehicles on the trail and the property, which is private, surrounding it. In response, NCON police are working with Connecticut State Police and police departments in Middlebury, Naugatuck, and Oxford to warn unauthorized riders that riding on the trail is not allowed in order to protect the rightful users of the trail and the long-term health of the trail itself, DEP said in a statement Monday. These agencies take these reports very seriously and are concerned with the impact that illegal operators are having on the public, the agency continued. The operation of ATVs and off-road vehicles on this trail is strictly prohibited and can result in a fine for the operator. According to DEP, off-road vehicles in Connecticut must be registered and cannot be used on state-owned land without permission. Off-road operators are also prohibited from operating in a negligent manner, that's in quotes, that endangers other people or property damage and cannot operate their vehicles unreasonably fast, the agency said. Operators who off-road on private land must carry written permission from the landowner. These violations are punishable by infraction and can lead to the seizure of the vehicle, DEP said. Many communities have recently enacted additional local ordinances to further address these circumstances, and it is the responsibility of the individual rider to be aware of these laws. Environmental officials have discouraged anyone who witnesses the use of off-road vehicles on or around the Larkin State Park Trail from confronting the riders. Instead, witnesses have been asked to take photos or record the activity and report it to DEP. This illegal activity is causing damage to our lands and placing the health and safety of law-abiding citizens at risk, DEP said. We encourage the public to report these activities and to call their local police departments and report these activities as they are occurring. Coyote sightings in Connecticut have been on the rise in recent weeks, a trend environmentalist says falls in line with the end of their mating season and is to be expected each April. We do get reports of them every year, especially this time of year, because right now the mated pair has their pups, and the pups are now big enough to start emerging from the den, said Jeffrey Krukar, a wildlife biologist with the State Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. Most recently, police in Westport said they have received several reports of coyotes attacking dogs. None of the attacks were reportedly fatal, police said in a statement earlier this week. According to Krukar, coyotes have been found in every city and town throughout the state. This time of year, he said, DEP receives numerous reports of the animals being sighted, especially in suburban areas where someone might not expect to find them. They're a species that can do well near human settlements, Kugler said. They're pretty adaptable. They're a species that does well in a huge variety of habitats. Many people who report seeing coyotes have safety concerns about themselves or their pets. Environmental officials recommend taking dogs out on a leash, as an attack is much likely less than when a human is present. Extremely rare for a coyote to go after a human being, Krukler said. Most encounters involving dogs stem from a coyote seeing them as a threat to their pups. Oftentimes, the coyote will follow a dog and walk parallel to their path to essentially escort them away from the territory where the coyote's family is, Krukar said. In instances involving small dogs or cats, the coyote can look at them as a food source and attack. According to DEP, their diet consists predominantly of mice, woodchucks, squirrels, rabbits, deer, some fruits, carrion, and when available, garbage. But some coyotes will also prey on small livestock, poultry, and small pets. Landowners looking to rid themselves of coyotes either need to do it before they establish a den for mating season in late February or early March, or wait until after their pups are born and have grown enough to relocate, which is generally around mid to late April. To get rid of coyotes, Krukar said, they need to, quote, feel like it's an unwelcoming area. He recommends spraying them with a hose, yelling, blasting an air horn, or throwing golf balls or tennis balls in their area. They will actually relocate dens, he said. Many people unknowingly have a coyote den under their shed, deck, or similar structures and only become aware of it around this time of year when the pups start to emerge. Landowners can take steps to prevent coyotes from establishing a den on their property by removing things like outdoor pet food or bird seed, which can attract rodents that coyotes will feast on. Once the den has been vacated, Krukar recommends filling it in and blocking it off, as they often will be reused in the upcoming mating season. Though DEP does not keep statistics on the coyote population, in Connecticut, Krukar said, it seems to be a pretty stable population. I don't know that it's increasing, he said. It definitely doesn't seem to be decreasing. According to DEP, coyotes migrated to the Northeast from the Western Plains and the Midwestern part of the country. They were first reported in Connecticut in the 1950s and are generally larger than their Western counterparts, as it is believed that they crossbreeded with Canadian gray wolves at some point. And though some people don't mind their presence, Krukar said it is both dangerous and illegal in Connecticut to feed coyotes. It attracts the animals and can lead to begging behavior that can include an animal becoming aggressive and start nipping to ask for food. Those animals have to be removed from the population because they're dangerous. Does the thought of peanut butter jelly and pickled jalapenos on a cheeseburger make you want to cringe? If so, you may want to reconsider and give it a try. At the Spicy PB&J Burger is a sign at the new Soulfully Vegan Eatery in Berlin. One reviewer wrote, I ordered the Spicy PB&J with regular fries, and this is a contender for best burger ever, meat burgers included. In 2022, the unusual burger sold from Soulfully Vegan's food truck at the Big E and won for best savory snack out of hundreds of vendors. They, the customers, say, I can't believe this actually works, co-owner Calvin Vaughn said of the burger, helping to put them on the map. The Vaughn and his wife, Allison Vaughn, both are vegans, opened the brick and mortar in late November, and it's become so popular, it's shoulder room only most weekends, Allison Vaughn said. Soulfully, Vegan sells vegan burgers with all kinds of toppings, as well as vegan hot dogs, chili, french fries, a chicken sandwich, salads, and shakes. The menu is small but flavorful, customers say. They carry the types of food vegetarians and vegans often crave or miss from the meat-eating days but can't find easily, Allison Vaughn said. People say, I haven't had a hot dog like this in 30 years. It's because we cook on an open flame. They flame grill products for that special taste, smother loaded fries and other items in veg and bacon, and use a lot of their from-scratch vegan cheese sauce. The vegan community considers us to be a fast food option, and the non-vegan community considers us their healthy alternative, Allison Vaughn said. We meet everyone's needs, and while the couple's food is appreciated by vegetarians and vegans throughout the state and beyond, Allison Vaughn said most of the customers are not yet vegan, but rather looking for healthful food. Flavor comes first, vegan second, Allison said of their philosophy on food. We're in a time when habits are changing. Most people are not vegan, but may do a meatless Monday. Her chili is popular and made with a secret recipe so coveted to this day I won't tell Calvin, she said. Spicy PB&J burger was created playfully by Allison Vaughn for her husband, a nod to his love of peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. And one more story. The Meriden Daffodil Festival resembles a lot of other community outdoor springtime festivals in Connecticut, but there are several big distinctions. One is the hundreds of thousands of daffodils that bloom all around Meriden's Hubbard Park at this time of year. Another is the sheer size of the park, which allows for carnival rides on one side, a theater of the trees area where children's activities, a gigantic food tent, and an artisan craft fair with dozens of booths situated near the park's small lake. For those in the Connecticut music scene, the Daffodil Festival is known as one of the largest showcases of local bands in the state. The festival is legendary for booking the internationally renowned band, the MGMT, which formed at Wesleyan University for its first off-campus gig and hosting an impromptu reunion of Miracle Legion during a set from its frontman, Mark Mulcahy, when that band had been broken up for years. And while cover bands, tribute bands, and party bands are welcome, original local pop and rock bands are also in the mix. This year's festival takes place May 4th from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. and May 5th from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. That's this coming weekend. Shuttle buses bring festival goers to Hubbard Park from Meriden Mall and Lincoln Middle School. There is no parking at the park. Traditionally, the festival has happened on the last weekend of April. This year is happening on the first weekend of May. 30 different bands are on the 2024 Meriden Daffodil Festival schedule. The acts are spread out over three stages. The welcome stage is at the entrance to the festival. The food tent stage is inside the large covered food tent where dozens of food vendors are serving everything from strawberry shortcake to burgers and hot dogs. The bandshell stage is a permanent structure near the carnival rides and games. And they have a list of some of the performers. I can't read them all, but it says on Saturday, Fuster Cluck featuring singer, guitarist Chris Morata. That's 11 a.m. at the El Welcome Stage. Gaza, Latin music, 11:30 p.m. Food Tent Stage. Seth Adams, an accomplished local singer, songwriter, noon.